This episode discusses crime scenes, possible sexual assault, and autopsy. There are brief mentions of self-harm and suicidal ideation. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. This week, we take you back to Nashville, but in 1976. And then, it's a different city. And a different time, which seems to go without saying. 40-plus years, and you have not only a different landscape, but three more generations. As a longtime executive told the Nashville Business Journal, quote, "Nashville was a really small town then. We didn't have tall buildings, or as much traffic." Looking at old photos of the skyline, that's not quite true. But what amounts to a city for business and what it means for people are sometimes two different things. He didn't mean that Nashville was bereft of culture, of course. The country scene was long thriving. But Nashville wasn't the sprawling, spreading place it is today, built up, drawing in new residents from all over the South and farther afield. In the Tennessean newspaper archives, you can see March of 1976 remembered in a series of mostly black and white pictures, a dozen or more of them. A young Albert and Tipper Gore stumping for his U.S. House of Representatives run. High school cheerleaders in hot pant jumpsuits. Intense coaches and players frozen with a basketball in the air. A celebration of the Humane Society's new shelter, where everyone is holding a dog or a cat. One of the few color photos shows off Hendersonville police cruisers repainted with red, white, and blue detailing for the bicentennial. There's a Hilton in the stages of construction with the T-O-N cranked halfway up the building. There's Narville Feltz performing at the Exit Inn. The annual country radio music seminars held at the Airport Hilton. Minnie Pearl commands a crowd at the Grand Ole Opry. Life happens, big and small. It's a picture, but it's not the whole one. It never can be. Underneath the city's drift are the other currents. People who are lost. People who come through, headed in all directions. And the 1970s were such a transitory time. Hitchhiking was still common. As Vox points out, laws banning the practice were just rolling into effect. Cars were becoming more commonplace for Americans of every income bracket and lasting longer. Campaigns to warn of hitchhiking, highlighting its dangers, had begun to gear up among the highway patrols and state police, but it was still a common way to cross a city or a state or even the country. And in March of 1976, two women, maybe teenage girls, their stories were hard to pin down exactly, hitchhiked their way to Tennessee. Witnesses claim this anyway, that there were two, and that they said they were going further south. That was the story. We don't know if this is an accurate account, but it's all the police had to go on. So, it began something like this. On March 15th, 1976, two men from East Nashville, Charles Moore and Milton Collins, said they were on Interstate 24, heading southeast, when they picked up two hitchhikers. The men were in Milton Collins' truck at the time. Some people online have speculated that it could have been a big rig, but Detective Matthew Filter of the Metro Nashville PD says that, to his knowledge, it was a non-commercial vehicle, a pickup truck. Charles Moore thought that it was around 1:30 p.m. when they pulled over to pick up the two women. The men reported the hitchhikers were maybe teenagers and maybe young adults. One of the hitchhikers was a thin, short, white female with sandy blonde hair. She wore glasses, jeans, and a black blouse. The men said that she told them that her husband, quote, lived in Haines City, Florida, which was their destination. The other young woman had a medium brown complexion and long dark hair. She was described as, quote, Hispanic or Native American. The men did not describe her in further detail, but they did recognize her when police asked them about certain details. Per police files, she wore distinctive jewelry, a choker set with a white dove and beads, and a rawhide bracelet. There was a small mole near her left eye, and she also wore blue jeans and a brown leather belt. And she was carrying a picture of a little boy, a toddler really, in her jeans pocket. It was said to be a picture of the other girl's son. That's what they told the men. The women were carrying a single suitcase, but no identification. That's what Charles Moore told police. He recalled that the dark-haired young woman said that her name was Sherry or Cheryl. We're going to call her Sherry in this episode, but it could have been either. Neither man could recall a name given by the second girl, the one with the husband in Florida. Charles and Milton weren't headed all the way to Florida, but they gave the young woman a ride that got them, as CBS News reports, 85 miles closer to their destination. And on the way, they talked. According to police files, Sherry told the men, quote, they had $20 between them and that they could take care of themselves. Both girls said that they were runaways from some type of institution. Sherry stated that she was there for alcoholism and the other girl was there for attempting to take her life, end quote. One thing they didn't find out was the two girls' ages. The men told Metro Nashville police that they took the two young women as far as the I-24 exit at Winchester. There, Charles Moore gave them his phone number, in case they happened to come back through Nashville. But they didn't have any paper with them. So, Sherry pulled out the picture of the other girl's child from her pocket, and he wrote across the back, Little Charlie. His father, you see, was Big Charlie, and then he added his phone number. The men reported that, quote, the last time they saw the girls, they were hitchhiking at the exit, and a pickup truck stopped and picked the two girls up, and the truck headed south on the interstate. One of the men thought, quote, it was a light brown pickup truck, and the other thought it was a late model blue pickup truck. So, the two young women should have been on their way to Florida. Maybe they were. How far they made it, we don't know. Perhaps the blonde woman was reunited with her son. Maybe Sherry was on her way back or headed somewhere else. Perhaps it had just been a story. Something to tell two men in a truck, or another invention entirely. We can't know, and we won't guess. What we do know is this. Sherry, if that was her name, somehow came back to Nashville. If the witness's story was accurate, she traveled back north at least 85 miles, if not more, maybe all the way back from Haines City, across several states. How long had she been in Tennessee? There were no signs of her. Not until Wednesday, March 24th, 1976. On that day, a fisherman discovered the body of a young woman caught up against a tree in the Harpeth River in Nashville, not far from a bridge on McCrory Lane. Per the Tennessean, the young woman was found face down in about 3 feet of water. She was dressed in jeans and a white bra. Later, the Nashville Banner reported that a blue polka dot blouse was found, quote, about 3 miles upstream, caught on a small tree, end quote, but Metro Nashville police couldn't conclusively state that it belonged to her. At the time, then-Detective Pat Griffin told the Nashville Banner, we're not certain the blouse was hers, but it's a good possibility. At first, authorities thought that she might be in her early 20s, but that was later amended. Sherry Jane Doe was probably somewhere between 14 and 17 years old. And according to police records, she died within the last 24 hours. The scanned PDF of her autopsy that's in our possession is really difficult to read. It's because the original is so faded. Detective Filter's copy is just as hard to make out, particularly on the first page, but there are a few notes that are clear. Sherry Jane Doe is noted as having burns on her upper left arm and shoulder area. In separate reports, these marks were described as, quote, possible healed cigarette burns. She also had two surgical scars on her abdomen, but there's no notation regarding possible theories as to what surgery she might have had. They were not noted as recent. In fact, there are very few details in the autopsy report. Because of that, there are a few things that we can't explain as well as we'd like. We're not certain precisely how she died. Drowning is most likely, but how she entered the water, Whether she fell in or was thrown or dumped or entered on her own isn't something that can be determined. In newspapers, Sherry Jane Doe's cause of death was identified as drowning. The manner is marked as undetermined in the autopsy, at least in the spot we can make it out, though we've consistently seen it discussed as accidental in the media. Most of the information is contained in a condensed list of handwritten notes on the second page of the autopsy, something Detective Filter believes was probably written by an investigator on the case versus the medical expert. It's as if the investigator was writing a summary of the information uncovered in the exam while listening to an oral explanation presented by the medical expert who just conducted it. The notes read as follows. Number 1, no criminal activity. Number 2, fell in the river and strangled on water. Did not drown. Number 3, very drunk. Number 4, bruise on arm, no indication of foul play. Number 5, died of asphyxiation. The notation that she fell in the water, that's not something that we can fully unpack, as there were no witness reports that can definitely tell us Sherry Jane Doe actually fell, or whether she was pushed, or thrown, or tossed. It seems the medical expert was theorizing that she likely fell in. That's also what no criminal activity indicates. It's highlighted again when the bruise on her arm is specifically mentioned. Sherry Jane Doe actually had a few bruises noted on her chart. We don't know why the bruise on her arm was ruled as no indication of foul play in this context. Without more information concerning the effects of water, the medical legal professional's thoughts on when the bruising may have occurred, and other context, we can't guess as to why this is listed as no indication of foul play. Though the list doesn't specify, we do want to add another important detail. A more contemporary detective later noted that Sherry Jane Doe had sexual intercourse within a few days of her death. There were not clear signs of trauma in that context, but as our audience knows, that does not rule out assault. As for the phrase, very drunk, the third page of her autopsy report contains the results of her tox screen, which was run for ethanol and barbiturates. She was negative for the latter, but her blood alcohol content, or BAC, was 0.28. For perspective, that's about 3.5 times the legal limit. Sherry Jane Doe was about 5'2" and about 125 pounds. So a BAC of 0.28 is considered very dangerous for a person of that size. Certainly, if she entered the water voluntarily or by force, she could have been so impaired that she would have been unable to safely leave the river. Finally, we took the most confusing aspects of the autopsy description, quote, fell in the river and strangled on water, did not drown, and, quote, died of asphyxiation, to a forensic pathologist, but she was not able to guess precisely what this was meant to indicate. Without notes on Sherry Jane Doe's lungs and more specifics, she simply could not interpret what the note specified. For our part, we have wondered if the 1976 examiner was commenting on the lack of water in Sherry Jane Doe's lungs, but again, that's absolutely just a guess. When we spoke with Detective Matthew Filter about Sherry Jane Doe's case, he expanded on a number of the issues that had left us with questions.
So, on this particular case, there are a few aspects of the description of the decedent that seem to make it possible that she could have experienced some kind of assault prior to her drowning. In your opinion, is there enough information available now, 40 years later, to discuss her death as undetermined rather than accidental?
Yes. There's a couple different places in the case file that one lists the manner of death as accidental, and then there was another spot in there that listed it as undetermined. I have reservations just based on some of the circumstances surrounding her death that it would necessarily be accidental. I think they listed it as accidental just because she didn't have any significant injuries or any other injuries that would have contributed to her death. And her BAC was extremely high at a 0.28. So drowning was probably the most likely cause of death. And that's what's listed by the medical examiner is death by drowning. But I would certainly say that listing it as undetermined at this point would be a better avenue just because of the general way she was found and circumstances surrounding her death and the location she was at.
In web forums, there's been a fair amount of discussion about the depth of the water where Sherry Jane Doe was found and where she might have entered the river, whether she drowned after entering the water under her own power or was thrown or dumped into it. And there's been some disagreement as to whether a person could drown in water of that depth. So we asked Detective Filter for his thoughts.
Where she was located was really close to a bridge in a common parking area, an area that was accessible to the public where people could park and go fish off the bank or put a boat or canoe in the river. So I believe that she was likely in that particular area, or she went in the water right in that particular area, probably not more than 100 yards or so from where she was originally found. As far as the depth of the water, I think that the depth of the water doesn't really matter a whole lot because people can drown in just a few inches. And considering her BAC as high as it was, I can cite an example of a recent case that we worked in our unit where a woman went missing and we knew she was very intoxicated and she disappeared around a lake. And it wasn't until a few days later we found some surveillance video where we actually saw her where she fell off of a pier and probably wasn't in more than 3 or 4 feet of water, but she was just so intoxicated that she could not walk out of the lake. She would stand up and start walking and fall right back down. And after that happened about 6 or 7 times, she just all of a sudden never came back up. So the depth of the water, that 3 or 4 feet and as high of a blood alcohol content as this girl had, I think it's very possible that they are right in labeling the cause of death as drowning.
When Sherry Jane Doe was found, she only had a few items in her pockets. A nickel,
a comb,
and a photo of the small blonde child that we mentioned earlier in the episode. When investigators first examined the picture, they discovered the still legible words Little Charlie and the accompanying phone number, and they called it. And that's when they became aware of Charles Moore and Milton Collins. According to police files, when Metro Nashville PD called the Little Charlie number, they first asked if anyone was acquainted with a Hispanic or Native American woman. The man who answered the phone said that his wife was Native, but that they were currently estranged. When the detective asked the man on the other end of the line his name, he learned of the existence of Big Charlie and Little Charlie. He was speaking to Little Charlie. Per police files, he also learned of Little Charlie and his wife that, quote, they were living separately and that he had not seen her in approximately a week and a half. With that possible lead, arrangements were made for Charles to view Sherry Jane Doe's body. Quote, he stated it was not his wife, but he did recognize her as being one of the two girls he and his brother-in-law had picked up hitching on March 15, 1976. That's when Charles identified his own handwriting on the photo of the child and explained his nickname and the story of giving his phone number to the young women. Charles and his brother-in-law were questioned and relayed the story we told you at the opening of this episode. Per police records, quote, both men agreed to take polygraphs if necessary, but there are no further records indicating that they did so. They did give Metro Nashville Police a lead that Sherry Jane Doe may have traveled from St. Paul, Minnesota. If you'll recall, the young woman purportedly told the witnesses that they'd left a hospital in that state. When Metro Nashville Police reached out to the St. Paul Police Department, the following was recorded by a Metro Nashville Police detective. Quote, I talked to the supervisor in the records division, and she checked their records for runaways or escapees. That's when the supervisor found a record dated 3/9/76 for a woman who left the Ramsey Hospital in St. Paul, and her description was as follows: 5'2", 120 to 125 pounds, and black hair. But when the detective called the Ramsey Hospital and inquired, they said they'd never had a patient by that description or name. Though the 1976 detective went back and forth with the St. Paul police and the hospital, he was not able to find an answer regarding the discrepancy in the reports. And there was never any mention made in the St. Paul police reports about a possible second missing young woman, the Sandy blonde that the two witnesses had described. When we spoke with Detective Filter, we had a few questions regarding the witnesses, the blonde friend they described, and the St. Paul story.
In some ways, this case seems to have an unusual amount of information compared to a lot of the unidentified persons cases that we cover, because Metro Nashville was able to establish contact with some witnesses who saw the young woman, or said they had, within a few days of her death. They were able to provide a significant amount of information regarding where the woman said she'd been, where she was going, etc. But Metro Nashville was not able to find, as you mentioned, a hospital or rehab center that had record of her as a patient, at least one that matched the description that she had of the decedent. Do you think there's any reason to suspect that she might not have been from Minnesota?
That's a question that I've often pondered myself. I mean, these two gentlemen that picked our unidentified girl up and the other girl that she was traveling with, most of the information that we got regarding her came from them. And from reading the reports on the interviews that were conducted with these guys, it doesn't appear as though they were lying about anything, but it's very strange how they drop them off in one place because they're heading to Florida. But then only about a week or so later, this girl is found deceased back in Nashville.
Were they ever re-interviewed after their initial interviews?
No, they've never been reapproached, at least not yet. I've never reapproached them because I don't really have anything more to ask them at this point. There hasn't been enough new information to either confirm or refute anything that they've said.
Did your office ever get leads on the missing woman who was traveling with the decedent, or any reports of another unidentified person that may have matched her description?
No, believe it or not, we never identified this other woman. I believe at the time they put out some information on the description and they tried to send teletypes back in the 70s. That's how we communicated with law enforcement and other agencies, is through teletypes inquiring about anybody that fits this description that would have been traveling with our unidentified girl. And to my knowledge, there's nothing in the case file that indicates that any leads came up that identified this girl or even gave them any inclination of who this girl was.
In our research into the case, we came across a few references that made us think that the picture of the boy that was found with her body had been circulated at some point that seems to have been the child of the friend that she was traveling with. Are there any plans to re-release that photo in hopes of identifying her companion?
I don't know whatever happened to that photo, unfortunately. So there's really no way for me to re-release it.
We have found some indications that this photo of the little boy was run or shared in some way, perhaps on the local news, but we have not seen it in any digital news archives. And as Detective Filter mentioned, when he received the file, the photo was already gone. If you have somehow come across this photo in your own research, please do reach out to us or to Metro Nashville PD so that it can be recirculated. So, there's no hard proof that Sherry Jane Doe's friend might be a missing person or an unidentified person. We can't even know for sure that there were two women at all. But if the story we have is accurate, that there were two, and they were heading to Florida, perhaps the sandy-haired blonde made it there. Maybe she's lived on this entire time without knowledge of her friend's death. The story of Sherry Jane Doe's recovery would not have traveled that far. In the first months of the investigation, Metro Nashville Police concentrated on Minnesota and the surrounding areas, and they did receive some communications they followed up on, something that we discussed with Detective Filter, and this did include teletypes from law enforcement across the nation.
Reading through the report, we noticed that Metro Nashville was in communication with police in St. Paul, Minnesota, Florida, even in Canada, and along the Mexican border. Did any tips as to possible leads on her identity come in from those areas?
The only tip that I actually saw, an actual tip, is from Canada. They had a missing person that they thought might be our unidentified girl here. But after they did some research into it, they were able to eliminate her. All the other information was the detectives at the time reaching out to other places, specifically up to a hospital in St. Paul where they thought that these two girls may have escaped from. And I know they at one point actually found out that there was a woman that went missing. There was actually a missing persons report, and this woman was supposed to have been in that hospital for some kind of psychiatric care. But it turned out that there was a mistake, and for some reason, the woman wasn't actually taken to that hospital and was taken somewhere else. They were able to eliminate her as they located her with the St. Paul, Minnesota Police Department. But other than the one tip from Canada and just a few other missing persons cases that some agencies called and said, hey, this might be her, all of these tips or leads have been eliminated as being our unidentified.
As for the theory of the young women's possible origin, Detective Filter had this to say.
Whether they're from Minnesota or not, it's always been a question that I've had. There's a lot of missing persons, not just in Minnesota, but also in the Dakota area. And so I've taken a look at some of those. And there's also been some missing people from other tribal nations. At this point, I'm not specifically going to just limit myself to Minnesota. I would be willing to look at anything on any missing person from anywhere.
Yeah, we even saw an early news report that a man had mentioned Alabama as an early lead.
Right. I believe that Alabama lead was eliminated. But yeah, certainly. I mean, you got very little to work with in identifying somebody. You got to leave the door wide open until you can confirm something or get a lead that you know is putting you on the right path.
Sherry Jane Doe's fingerprints were taken and sent out at the time of her recovery. But of course, there were no matches. Because she was found so soon after death, her post-mortem photographs captured a good likeness of what she looked like in life. Good records were taken of her teeth, including radiographs and a full chart of dental work that could be compared to a missing person, if a tentative match was found. And after hair samples were taken, she was interred in one of Nashville's indigent burial grounds. We've discussed how different cities handle the remains of unidentified persons. There are no national standards for where and how remains are maintained. Now, in the age of investigative genetic genealogy and DNA science, we approach sampling and protecting paths to identity very differently. But in recent decades, cremation, unmarked graves, and even burial at sea have been normal practices. The result is that there are many cases where DNA identification is simply not possible. Her remains were, per the police file, quote, buried in a potter's field on 18th Avenue North. Unfortunately, the graves at that site are unmarked now, and no map exists to help authorities guess where Sherry Jane Doe might be buried. Our understanding is that at one time there were markers, but that they shifted and were eventually picked up and fully removed from the site. That means that the kind of excavation that took place in Detroit, which we covered in our episode on Operation United's efforts to identify Doe decedents in Michigan, that would be hard to tackle in Nashville. When we researched the burial site at 18th Avenue North, There were even indications that there may be at least one mass grave at the site as well. According to a Nashville Scene article that touches on the history of the cemetery, quote, there are stories of thousands of Mexican laborers interred in a mass grave in 1918, victims of a flu epidemic at the powder plant in Old Hickory. With so many deceased and no idea where to dig, Metro Nashville Police currently have no plans to attempt exploratory excavation or exhumation. If you listen to our series on Lorion Nicholson, who was also interred through Nashville's Indigent Burial Program as an unidentified person, we want to note that he was placed at a different site, where the markers are still in place, the Bordeaux Cemetery. So the quest to identify Sherry Jane Doe is limited by a serious roadblock. There is no DNA available in her case, and no practical way of seeking DNA. Her hair samples are no longer available. However, the photos from her autopsy are still on record, and her forensic art is extremely accurate. There are also dental charts, not radiographs, unfortunately, but charts available that record the work done on her teeth that could be used in a match. Photos of her teeth still exist as well, and that could be significant because several write-ups of Sherry Jane Doe's case mention a unique tooth that loved ones or a dental professional might recognize. We read several times that Sherry Jane Doe has been described as having, quote, a twisted fang tooth, or as noted on the Doe Network, quote, a left fang tooth that was oddly positioned. They're speaking of Sherry Jane Doe's left canine. These descriptions don't tell us much, though, about how her tooth actually appeared. When teeth are unique, they can help solve a case, whether it's through comparison of dental charts or radiographs, or because a friend or relative or dentist recognizes a picture or description. It's been regular practice for forensic odontologists to share descriptions, drawings, and other information in national dental publications in hope of finding the practitioner who worked on a decedent's teeth. Someone who might recognize their own work or unusual or unique dentition. I've seen a listing from the 1990s that included a sketch of a molar with three roots and a silver point filling. The odontologist hoped another dentist might recognize it. But Sherry Jane Doe's teeth have never been publicly described in detail, and there's also no illustration of them to share with the public. When we began collaboration with Detective Matthew Filter on this case, we secured permission to share postmortem photos of Sherry Jane Doe's teeth with Dr. Rich Scanlon, a nationally known forensic odontologist, and with Dr. Stefan Poltak, an anatomist and medical illustrator. I worked with both these experts on my upcoming book, Lay Them to Rest, which is out this October. There's a link in the show notes if you want to learn more. Dr. Scanlon worked as a forensic odontologist with NAMIS and actually filled out the dental chart on Sherry Jane Doe during his time there. It's one of the many, many things he's done during his career, from working at one of the crash sites during 9/11 to working to identify victims during major natural disasters. I asked Dr. Scanlon to give us a thorough written description of Sherry Jane Doe's teeth that could accompany Dr. Poltak's new forensic art and be shared with the police and the public. Here's what Dr. Scanlon wrote. Quote, here's what I've observed from the dental photographs and the chart. First, the tooth in question is the maxillary left canine or cuspid, referred to as tooth 11 in the dental charting. Also, these adult canines are the last of the anterior teeth to erupt, followed by the second molars and then the third molars. If the root formation of the second molars was complete and the third molars are not complete, this young lady would be at least 14 and a half to 15 and a half years old. The canine we discussed in the photo normally erupts around 11 and a half to 12 years of age. However, what's happening with the canine, tooth 11 in the photo, is that it has insufficient space to erupt normally in the arch, and the tooth posterior, the first bicuspid, and the lateral blocked it anterior and forced it to erupt superior and anteriorly to the normal curvature of the arch. Because this canine, number 11, is larger and has a longer root, the eruption pressure is sufficient to push the lateral tooth, number 10, posteriorly, as seen in this photo. I don't believe the canine is twisted, however, but that's probably a layman's thoughts rather than a dentist or pathologist observation. This is not that uncommon and is a major reason for braces. When I was in practice, I often extracted the tooth behind the canines, the first bicuspid, as the canine was erupting as it was obvious that it had no room in the arch. This then prevents the pushing of the lateral out of position and allows the canine to erupt in the arch in the space of the extracted bicuspid. This movement was facilitated by the weakness of the bone in the area of the socket of the extracted bicuspid. Often tongue and lip pressure in a few years align the arch satisfactorily and improve the child's appearance. To aid in the ID of this person, if possible, a smiling photograph at around 11 to 13 years of age would help provide additional corroborative evidence. But often, children with this fang-like appearance tend not to smile in photographs due to shyness or embarrassment. To better illustrate what Dr. Scanlon just described, we obtained permission to commission forensic art of Sherry Jane Doe's maxillary or top teeth, those that would be visible when she smiled. Dr. Stefan Poltak's drawing shows the unique angle of her canine in a clear manner. We hope that anyone who knew her will recognize it. You'll be able to view the art and description on our social media and website. We commissioned this art for public use, and we've shared it with Metro Nashville PD. We're happy to share it with the Doe Network and other sites, anyone that publicizes cold cases. As we said, her current portrait forensic art is extremely accurate, so the addition of the dental forensic art is simply meant to spark possible further memories. Even if Sherry Jane Doe didn't smile in her middle school photos, something that a lot of us didn't do, we hope that people who knew her will recognize this unique pattern, especially when it's shared in conjunction with her facial approximation. To touch back on her age, some reports did mention that Sherry Jane Doe might be as old as her early 20s. We know Dr. Scanlon is confident that she's at least 14 or 15, but we asked Detective Filter if Metro Nashville PD is considering any older possible matches.
I know that the victim has had a few updates regarding age and ancestry estimations, and we've discussed with our audience that that is very normal, particularly as science advances. In this case, I know that the victim's age range has varied. Should we keep that flexible? Should we view her as being perhaps 14 to 17, or should we also consider missing persons who are in their 20s?
From what I read with the autopsy report, and I believe a forensic odontologist looked at her teeth, and I believe this age, 14 to 17, was based on the development of her teeth at that point. I would have to say that 14 to 17 is a pretty accurate estimation. I wouldn't discredit if something came up where maybe there was a 19 or 20 year old. It's very possible that she could have been a few years older than 17, but I believe that the 14 to 17 year range is fairly accurate.
There is another possible lead to the answer of Sherry Jane Doe's identity, one that detectives have not previously detailed in public. This is fairly recent information that has come in since Detective Filter took on the case.
We did have a lady that contacted me and said that she believes this to be her mother. And based on the information she provided, there's a very strong possibility that this is her mother. I mean, she described some information regarding scars that are on the body and described the teeth and the alcoholism that she struggled with. But unfortunately, she doesn't know a whole lot about her mother because she was given up for adoption when she was just an infant. And the little bit that she learned about her mother was from her adoptive parents. And normally we would go and talk to the adoptive parents to try to get more information, but her adoptive parents are now deceased. So we really don't know where else to look for that kind of information. If we knew perhaps the adoption agency that was utilized, we might be able to get records from them to try to figure out who she might be or who her mother was. But even with the strong possibility that this unidentified girl is this woman's mother, it's going to be rough trying to verify that with the very limited information that we have to work with.
There's some information that the woman who contacted Detective Filter had and that we've been cleared to share with you. Here's what we know about the mother that the woman called about. Her name was Sherry Jones, or Sherry Smith, and she disappeared in about 1972. Sherry Jones was described as Puerto Rican. The woman caller was told her mother had at least one scar on her abdomen that was the result of what she described as, quote, a botched abortion, and that her mother's social security number had been issued in Tennessee. The woman caller said her mother was known to have a unique canine tooth, but that she had no photographs and no information about her mother's family. This information, if it is accurate, provides important clues toward Sherry Jane Doe's identification. The missing woman, Sherry Ann Jones, or Sherry Smith, which is listed as her alternate name, has been assigned a NamUs profile number, MP17106. Her case file also lists her as 24 years old at the time of disappearance, which is older than the dental estimations for Sherry Jane Doe suggest. Sherry Jones's eyes are described as brown and her hair is black. Her height is listed as 5'3" and her weight is 115, and her last known location is Greer, South Carolina, in Greenville County. Her race is listed as white, which would not seem to be photographically consistent with Sherry Jane Doe's autopsy records, but manually entered records do vary, especially when we consider how race has been interpreted and classified through the decades. And this is particularly true for Hispanic and Latino individuals in the U.S. whose, quote, race is classed differently, even between our current systems, such as NCIC and NamUs. You can learn more about that topic in our episode on Mississippi's Missing and Unidentified. Whether Sherry Ann Jones is Sherry Jane Doe, we can't say. But someone else may be able to answer that question. We cannot stress this enough. The forensic portrait done in her case is extremely accurate. It captures her likeness well. Combined with the new art we've commissioned to illustrate her unique dental features and the new information about possible locations, especially in South Carolina or even a hometown in Tennessee, we hope that new tips will come in. Photographic evidence or dental records or family evidence are all paths to resolving Sherry Jane Doe's case. We ask that you take time to study her forensic art, the portrait and the dental, and please, share it online. And if you or anyone you know has any information, reach out to Metro Nashville Police Department. You can contact Detective Filter at Metro Nashville Police at 615-862-7803. You can also call Nashville Crime Stoppers at 615-74-CRIME or 615-742-7463. Callers remain anonymous and qualify for a cash reward. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us and review us in your favorite podcast app. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. And if you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue that work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well, so you have an alternative way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove, Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Liz Lipka and Sarah Turney. As of November 2022, our monthly donation is going to Season of Justice to support their testing and family grant initiatives.